Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
According to a new study, researchers believe that fetal alcohol spectrum disorders could affect somewhere between 1 and 5% of all people. That's as many more people than are on the autism spectrum, yet the effects of fetal alcohol syndrome aren't nearly as well understood. Joining us to walk us through this new study is WBUR Common Health contributor Karen Weintraub. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Anthony.
So let's go back and get some background. Remind us what fetal alcohol spectrum disorder is.
It's just what it sounds like, disorders in the fetus caused by exposure to alcohol. Fetal alcohol syndrome is the most extreme form of the disorder. And researchers are realizing that this exposure can cause a lot more problems than they expected, from distinctive facial features to behavioral and emotional problems to significant health challenges like diabetes and heart and kidney trouble. I spoke about this with Dr. Michael Charnas, a neurobiologist with Veterans Affairs in Boston, Harvard Medical School, and Brigham and Women's Hospital. He was one of the researchers on the new study.
What is important to know about this disorder is that sometimes the challenges with behavior and social adaptability are among the most disabling consequences. And so some of these kids have trouble getting along in school. They can later get in trouble with the law. They have trouble in social interactions.
So, Karen, honestly, I've never heard of anyone being diagnosed with this. So what do we know about the rates of diagnosis of fetal alcohol spectrum?
Right. Diagnosis lags way behind reality, researchers found in this study. They discovered that 222 kids met the criteria for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, but only two out of those 222 had already been diagnosed.
Wow. So a big miss rate.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason it's taken until now to count these kids. They're disabled by alcohol exposure, but often in some subtle ways and not right from infancy. So doctors or teachers or even parents often don't know what's really going on.
So how did the researchers diagnose all of these cases?
They physically went into hundreds of first grade classrooms in four communities around the country to see if they could find the telltale signs of fetal alcohol syndrome. And did they? They couldn't be more precise than 1 to 5% because they only saw a small subsection of one age group in these four communities. But they say that this spectrum of disorders can have a profound effect, even if the child is, quote, normal enough to be in these regular classrooms that they looked at. And although there may be pockets of communities where the problem is particularly acute, the new study found consistent rates of fetal alcohol disorders from urban San Diego to rural North Carolina.
So really widespread. Now, can children outgrow these problems associated with fetal alcohol syndrome?
No. Although behavioral training and other kinds of supports can help children compensate, the challenges are lifelong. Dr. Charnas hopes the new study will encourage more doctors to think about the possibility that their adult patients might have been exposed to alcohol in the womb.
People have to be vigilant, even in the adult population, to ask questions we're not used to asking, like, do you know if you were exposed to alcohol during pregnancy? A lot of adults don't know the answer to that question, but very few adults are asked.
Now, Karen, are any particular groups more vulnerable than other groups?
The study found similar rates in all four of the communities they studied, but earlier research has shown that women from households earning more than $75,000 a year are actually more likely to binge drink than those from lower earning households, potentially putting their fetuses at higher risk. I also talked to a psychiatrist who's found that about 40% of the kids in his inner city Chicago clinic have fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. He blames this preventable illness for filling our special education classrooms, our prisons. People with this condition, he says, often have trouble learning, especially math, and they have trouble with self-control, posing a risk to themselves and others.
Interesting. So now there have been conflicting advice over the years and theories about this, but what do we actually know about the effect of very modest alcohol consumption on a fetus? For example, if a pregnant mother has just one drink every once in a while.
I wondered about that too, but Dr. Charnas says that in animal studies, they can't find an amount of alcohol small enough to be safe during pregnancy. Of course, some mothers drink and their babies are just fine, but no one can predict who can get away with it and who can't. We know that binge drinking is terrible, but as Dr. Charnas says, even just a little social drinking might be dangerous too.
And there's pretty good evidence that concentrations of alcohol that one would have, that a woman would have and her fetus would have in their blood after just one drink are able to disrupt the function of molecules that are very important in brain development.
Dr. Charnas says that instead of blaming mothers, the focus should be on empowering them. Half of all pregnancies are unplanned, so many women will expose their future children before they even know that they're pregnant.
Day 17 is the day that's most sensitive for the development of fetal alcohol syndrome, the most extreme form of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, and that's just 2 days after the first missed menstrual period.
Wow. So that sounds like a pretty serious warning about alcohol and pregnancy.
Yep. Here's the point where we recommend that listeners who are trying to become pregnant or already are take up yoga or other forms of relaxation instead of drinking. And if you are drinking, it's best to use protection to avoid getting pregnant, the experts say.
All right. Well, that's Karen Weintraub. She's a contributor to WBUR's Common Health, and you can find a link to her post on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders at our website, radioboston.org. Karen, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Establishing a diet and fitness routine can be tough, but imagine how difficult it is for those who work with food every day. Chef Matt Jennings knows this all too well. 2 years ago, Jennings left his restaurant Farmstead in Rhode Island and started Townsman here in Boston, which is 4 times as big, which took a toll on Jennings, who began to overeat and he packed on the pounds. Then he made a commitment to healthier living, eating less, and managed to lose 160 pounds. He also wrote his first cookbook with a bunch of healthy recipes called Homegrown: Cooking from My New England Roots. Back in October, Radio Boston's Deborah Becker invited him into the WBUR kitchen to cook.
And so I thought it'd just be fun to do some pickles today. So we brought a couple different vegetables, a couple different fruits. We're going to do a little bit more of an Asian-style pickle in the jar, what's called a hot pickle. We're going to slice, and then...
We're slicing the fennel.
Yeah, we're going to slice the fennel. And then we're going to actually put a little bit into each jar. You can help me. Do you want to help me?
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Because I can't do it. I can't ride solo on this whole thing.
Okay.
Just make sure there's an even amount. And then I'm going to do the same thing. We have butternut squash here, which may be an unusual item to pickle, but I think it's like kind of fun.
I didn't even know you could pickle it.
Well, anything is game.
You want sprigs or you want me to...
No, sprigs are fine.
Sprigs.
No, sprigs are fine.
Now, your cookbook is about the cuisine of New England.
Yep.
Okay, so, you know, it's a little tough here. Got a lot of winter.
Right.
Maybe you don't want me to say that, but what is New England cuisine?
No, I love you saying that because I think... That's part and parcel to what being a cook in New England is about, is, you know, we go through this whole period where we're dealing with 134 inches of snow outside, like we were a couple winters ago, and then all of a sudden spring and summer comes and we have the kind of incredible growing season and we get to really celebrate what that means. So as a cook, I think it's exciting. But
what is New England cuisine then? Like, this is going to have a little bit of an Asian twist. So is it
sort
of a hybrid of a lot of different things, or how do you describe it?
Well, I mean, I think New England cuisine is ever evolving. And I think that, you know, part of the problem is, quite honestly, when people try to nail down what New England cuisine is. I mean, I think celebrating local producers, celebrating the immigrant influence that exists in New England, and working seasonally. And those things, for me, are all what defines New England food.
Several instances in the book you talk about cheese and how to make a perfect cheese board. What's the rule there?
Well, for me, I use a rule of five, which I think is really helpful to help create a balanced cheese board. So that would be a cow, a sheep, a goat, a blue, and a washed rind. So I like to have those three different milks utilized, as it shows a good spectrum of flavor and typically, you know, variety. And then it's always important to include a blue cheese of some sort or a washed rind cheese. So if you're not a blue person, that's fine. Washed rind cheeses are a really excellent way to kind of have something that's a little stinky, a little funky, a little different for those that are a little bit more adventurous. And I know you are. I can tell. And we're going to pour some vinegar. Watch out.
This is rice vinegar.
This is rice wine vinegar, yep. Just pour a little bit of that in there. And then I'm going to add some water a little closer to 50-50.
Okay.
These are some spices I've toasted off, which are juniper, coriander, allspice, cardamom, some peppercorn of various colors, a little bit of cinnamon stick, just some nice kind of fun wintry type spices. Fennel seed also.
Smells great.
Let's put it all in.
So you heat this up, just bring it to a boil.
Yep.
Pour it over our chopped vegetables. Right. How long does it sit?
Well, they're just going to cool in the jar. So we'll pour it over, and as they cool, they will pickle themselves with the hot liquid. That's kind of the beauty of the hot pickling method.
So why did you leave Providence for Boston and to open the Townsman?
For us, it was really just a family decision. We have two small boys, and the madness of having a husband-wife-owned restaurant and trying to do the balancing act and not be around family as they got older was challenging. So all of our families are here, and it was just kind of time to get some help.
Because you moved to a much bigger restaurant, right? It was
34 seats to 134, roughly. So a crazy learning curve over the last year, or the last 2 years, for sure. You know, admittedly, probably not the most brilliant move, you know, because at Farmstead, I was touching every plate. I was saying hello to every guest. As far as they knew, they felt like I was valeting their car also. I mean, it was kind of like that small and intimate of a thing. Townsman's definitely more brasserie style, kind of more lively. Any restaurateur will tell you can take up to, I think, a couple of years to really feel comfortable in the skin there. And I feel like we're finally there.
You got to. You've arrived.
Yeah, it's taken a little time, but it feels much better now than it did month one, two, and three. That's for sure.
Yeah, and actually, personally, it was difficult for you, right? You got yourself working so much that you weren't taking care of yourself.
Yeah. I think I was fulfilling the expectations of my guests. I was fulfilling the expectations of my employees, but not thinking too much about myself. And that happens in this business. It kind of just sneaks up on you.
You lost 150 pounds?
160, yeah.
160 pounds. You had surgery?
I did. It's unfortunate, I think, sometimes that the conversations always lead with, you know, you had weight loss surgery, which is absolutely true. But it's been a total commitment to changing mindset, you know, to changing the way you eat, your ability to carve time out of your schedule to exercise every day. I mean, it's intense.
No bread?
I try not to. I mean, that's the hardest thing for me, actually, out of the whole thing is like crusty baguette.
I know, right?
My God, it's like the greatest thing in the world, right? Yeah. Like a hot, fresh baguette torn apart, slathered with some butter and sprinkled with sea salt is like, hello. So that's like stuff like that I'll bend, you know, like it's not, my body's not that much of a temple, but I do try to stay away and I try to just make better choices and just be more mindful, I think is the thing. Spoon. I want to just see.
So making sure the sugar and salt are dissolved.
Exactly, making sure it's all dissolved. And I just want to kind of...
You taste it?
Yeah. You got to taste everything as you cook.
Even the vinegar for your pickles?
Oh, yeah. Everything. Because that makes me want a little bit more sugar. I know, you're looking at me like I'm a weirdo.
No, I'm not. I'm not really. But, now you have to taste everything, too. How do you really keep your weight off when you're tasting everything and you're cooking?
Well, balance, right? You get up and you ride 15, 20 miles on your bike. That's how I do it anyways. I don't know. No, it is a challenge. I mean, the biggest challenge in the restaurant environment is that I do still actively want to and need to taste everything that's going out of the kitchen, right? It's an important part of being a chef. So I look back now on my younger self and I see that I was always kind of, as I think a lot of us are when we first get into this industry, trying to live up to your own expectations, trying to live up to the expectations that you think people have of you, trying to live up to the expectations that you think your peers have of you. And you're not really cooking from a true, authentic, genuine place necessarily. And I feel like in the last kind of, for me, you know, 5-10 years, that's really been my focus is to kind of cook from my authentic self.
Kind of found your voice.
Yeah, I think I have. And I think that, you know, I cook what I want now. I cook what I think is delicious. At the end of the day, that's the most important thing to me is that somebody, you know, thinks it's tasty. And that we kind of celebrate those cultural nuances of food that we respect. And
that's sort of the ethos at Townsman, you would say, right?
Yeah.
But it's not exactly what's in your new cookbook, Homegrown. That's, I mean, it's similar ethos, but the recipes and the cooking are really for people to enjoy themselves, right?
Well,
so it's not a restaurant experience.
It's a very good point, and it's very important. You know, I've decided to make the recipes accessible but interesting. They're still tied into what my ethos of food is surrounding seasonality and regionality and celebrating, you know, some iconic New England classics in new ways.
Your mom's clam chowder.
My mom's clam chowder.
Alongside fancier clam chowder.
Right. Well, the reason my mom's clam chowder is in there is because she looked at my chowder recipe and told me that it was crap. So, so I said, well, why don't you put your recipe in the book? And she said, okay, I will. So it turned into mine and hers side by side. And I think that's exactly, you know, a great representation of what food means to me, right? It should be that jumping off point for conversation, for celebration, for relationships to develop. I mean, food for me is about people and it's about places and all of the amazing things that I've been able to kind of experience up until now. So if we could all cook more together and eat more together, we would have a lot less problems in this world.
Should we pour the vinegar?
I think we should.
Okay.
So I'm going to do it because I don't want you to burn yourself.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to pour this in. See that? Just hot, right in there. And we want to leave a little space at the top. So you don't want to go right to the top because you need to leave an air gap.
So about, what, a half inch?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Half inch is good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's fine. And it's fine that those spices go in there. It's totally cool to let them just kind of hang out because as you go back, obviously you'll be kind of picking through and making sure that you're not eating the full cardamom pods.
And so if you have a lot of spices in the bottom of the pan, should you scoop those up and put them
in
the jars?
That's exactly what you're hired.
All right.
I have an extra apron. I'm going to take you back to the restaurant with me.
All right. They look so beautiful.
Don't they?
Yeah, they really do. Well, the green, the squash, the apple, they're beautiful.
Yeah, and the more they sit, they actually will kind of, their colors will get even more vibrant.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming
thank
in
you.
And making pickles with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
Matt Jennings, chef and owner at Townsman in Boston, speaking with Radio Boston's Deborah Becker. Jennings' debut cookbook is called Homegrown, Cooking from My New England Roots, and he joined us back in October to talk about it. Oh, chalk and cheese, we rarely see eye to eye. I say you, you say am I. Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna and Allison Bruzek. We had help today from Zoe Mitchell, Lily Tyson, Anna Saldinger, and Susie Tapson. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering help today from Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.